This is the River Avenue Blues Podcast. I'm Joe Polakowski, joined by Jay Gordon.
Good day, everyone.
And we have a hell of a show ahead of us. We have ESPN insider's Keith Law running down his top 100 prospects list. Yanks had five players on that, plus a couple almost maids. So we're talking players, we're talking system, we're talking the whole Yankees organization.
And I know Keith is definitely a guy that knows the system pretty well. I mean, I've seen him at the Trenton Thunder Stadium, like charting pitches and watching players. Remember even back to the Betances and Bonuelos days of him. So very, very cool. Really looking forward to hearing you talk with him.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely mentions of him going to Trenton games. And there's a lot of Betances talk, actually, especially towards the beginning of the show. So it's interesting you bring that up.
Very, very cool. Why don't we take a listen to it now, man?
Joined right now by ESPN's Keith Law. Keith, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We are talking about Keith's recent top 100 prospects list. He had the 51 through 100 published on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, the big ones, the top 50 appeared. And the Yankees landed five players on that list. So, Keith, I just wanted to run down, do a really quick breakdown of the five before we go sure. into some of the more nuanced stuff behind the prospect rankings. So we'll start the opposite order that you put them out. You did it interestingly, actually, that it went 51 to 100 and then 1 to 50 rather than like a countdown. You just see a countdown.
I blame my editors. And not that I think they're wrong, but like I said to somebody on Twitter the other day, I said, I just write the words. Right. They do the formatting. They decide what the order is because I send them in. I have to send the capsules in before I finalize the order just for timing purposes so they can get everything edited and formatted. And literally Sunday afternoon, it ran Monday morning, Sunday afternoon, I said, all right, here's the final order, I think. And I still reserved the right to make a change, although I didn't. So I had no idea what it was going to look like. I found out when you guys found out that it was going to be 1 through 50, not 50 to 1.
I guess it makes sense. Everybody wants to read the Vlad Guerrero Jr. profile. You know, they're not so much caring about 50, so I guess being at the beginning makes sense.
Yes. The sexy names were definitely at the top.
Yeah. So let's jump into, starting from 100 back, and the Yankees had a guy close to 100 at number 99, Albert Abreu. So, rather than rehashing what you wrote about him, what was the big thing that you understood him to change, like the big change he undertook from when he was a low A ball guy with the Astros to last year?
I think he can start. That's actually maybe the biggest separator is that, and he's got some, I think everybody knew even at the time of the trade, I think I wrote at the time of the trade, like it's big stuff. There's no question he's got velocity. He's got arm strength. But I actually got nice reports on him during the season and did get to see him in the Arizona Fall League and thought, this guy probably is a starter. Whereas at the time of the trade, even the Astros folks were like, well, either of these guys, it was him and Jorge Guzman. They've both got a lot of reliever risk, which was probably true. And I don't think Abreu has a lot of command right now, but it's definitely a plus fastball. He's got good action on the changeup. It's kind of an in-between breaking ball, but it's pretty hard. And I think there's a chance that all three of those pitches end up above average and the delivery's good enough at least that I think he could start. Anybody with starter potential who's got the weapons to potentially be above average also, to me, is much more potentially valuable than guys with very low starter ceilings or guys who have huge bullpen risk.
And how much, so if say like he didn't go to the Arizona Fall League, you think he makes the list at all? Or was that like a really a deciding factor in him cracking the top 100?
It helped me certainly. There's a confidence level. And this is a constant issue with my list in particular, because I see a lot of players, but can't see everybody. And so I am often trying to do comparisons because it's all pairwise comparisons, everything, this guy or that guy. I mean, that's constantly when trying to order, even as now I'm doing organizational reports. It was typing up the Giants report today, which is not going to take very long. And this guy or that guy, this guy or that guy, constantly doing that. Boy, is it easier to have an opinion on a player when I've actually laid eyes on him. When it's a high profile guy who I've never seen, my solution is to I try to find even more scouts. Obviously, I'm talking to the scouts I know, but then it becomes, all right, let me get a third opinion, a fourth opinion, if I can find somebody else who saw this guy, to try to make up for the fact that I have not physically laid eyes on a player.
That's good. And I'm sure a lot of people will appreciate knowing that, because there's a lot of, when fans – I'm talking about fans in general here. When they – talk, when they debate prospects list, a lot of it does come down to, did you see the guy live? And it's, mm-hmm. it's good to know that, you know, when, you know, Baseball America and you, someone has seen the guy, or you have talked to someone who has seen the guy live. It's reassuring to know that there's that process going on.
Yeah, it has to, for me, obviously I look at the stats and mm-hmm. I talk to some front office guys who on the, in the R&D side, but really this to me is either I've seen him or I've talked to many people who've seen him, someone mm-hmm. from within the organization and then a couple of people from outside the organization. You know, other sites may do their lists completely differently, but mine, for me, the drive each year is to try to see as many of the top prospects as I can, limited a little by geography and budget, but that, you know, the hope is when I get to do the 100 at the end of the season, I can say, yeah, I've seen 80 of these guys live, at least in the last, you know, say 18 months.
Yeah, and that's, oh man, that's 80, see, being able to see 80 of the top 100, I mean, there's a lot of people that have heard that are pretty jealous.
Yes. Oh, I don't complain about my job. Nobody wants to hear it.
No. All right, so moving down, I'm going to – see, I never – this is a name that I'm going to definitely get wrong. I would call him Freischer Perez, but something in like the back of my head says Freischer Perez.
I have had scouts say Freischer, mm-hmm. So that's what I'm going with until we – like I didn't know how you said Luis Robert's name mm-hmm. until somebody asked him like 2 weeks ago in Arizona. So we'll go with just call him Perez.
Perez.
That'll work. Yes.
So he's – you have him listed too, and I saw his – so his baseball reference page, and then you listed him at 6'8", 190. I didn't think that was physically possible to be that tall and that light.
Like, yeah, well, I don't –
I'm
5'10", 190. Listed at.
I'm like,
yeah.
I'm 5'10", 190, and I'm not in any way overweight.
And I don't think he's 190 anymore. But getting accurate weights on guys can be difficult. Some organizations are fine. Like I've been on the phone with guys who said, hang on, I'll just look up what he weighed in at it in spring training. I don't know what he weighs now. I think he weighs more than that. I mean, he gets constantly compared to Dellin Betances, some of which is because he's a Latin American Yankee prospect. But also there's some physical similarities too. And Dellin Betances probably has 190 since he was 12.
So let's dive into that a little bit, because that's interesting to me because I, you know, you and every other prospect writer I knew back when Betances was a prospect would talk mm-hmm. about his repeatability of his motion, that he just yep. couldn't repeat his motion consistently. Is that something that Perez has a problem with right now?
He is much more athletic than Betances. That's the difference for me between those two guys. Betances did make the back of my 100 this year, but I talked a lot about what you just said and the fact that you can't repeat your delivery, you're not going to have command, he could potentially go to the bullpen. Betances is like a 20 athlete. He's one of the worst athletes I've ever seen in terms of a pitching prospect. He's not even good at fielding. He's not good at throwing to bases. Fortunately, he's very good at throwing the baseball, you know, past hitters, so that seems to mitigate some of the other issues. Perez is a better athlete. He does seem to repeat his delivery a lot better, and so there's more confidence that he can potentially be a starter. But of course, everyone who rolls in and sees him too, that Charleston club got scouted a ton because Esteban Florial was there and Blake Rutherford was there, and teams knew that the Yankees might be motivated to trade one or more prospects. So I talked to a lot of people who saw Perez, and everyone brings up Betances because I think it's easy, right? Yeah. How do you see this guy, this size, this organization, this kind of power? Is it, well, look, at worst, we'll put him in the pen and he'll be Betances. Mm-hmm. But there isn't really any evidence right now to say he can't start.
That's cool. So do you think he's a candidate to be at AA for a decent part of the year, or is he really, you know, kind of still baking in the A ball for right now?
My guess is he starts the year and probably spends at least half the year in Tampa, and mm-hmm. then we'll see how he does. They're pretty aggressive about running guys out of Tampa up to Trenton, which is great for me because Trenton's an hour from my house and I'm there all the time. And because it's a much better challenge. I mean, I think they're completely right to do that. If you send a guy to Tampa, he's not playing in front of a lot of fans, the weather stinks in the middle of the year, and if he's playing well, hitter or pitcher, move him up to AA. It's a much bigger test, and teams are a lot more confident trading for a guy from AA too. I think one of several reasons they moved Jorge Mateo up when they did, even though he was not playing well in high A, if he goes to AA and even just flukes into a good month, well, guess what? Everyone's seeing him now do better against better competition with actual fans in the seats. And I mean, that's exactly what happened. They ended up able to trade him. I think he'd only been in Trenton about a month. I saw him, and within a week, he'd been traded.
Yeah, it feels like you wrote three paragraphs about Mateo, and twice you mentioned that the lack of effort was kind of a thing with him.
Yeah, yes. And not that he's a bad kid. Like, I don't want to make him sound like, you know, he's going to end up in jail or something. It's not that, but that One, it bothers me when I see players with that kind of ability who don't play hard and they're not performing too. This is what you want to get to the next level. You want to get to the big leagues. You're going to have to certainly put in more effort. And also, I think the Yankees for a while were not in response to lack of effort and some minor, very minor off-field stuff that he got suspended for a year or two ago. But the flip side was, I think he was moping to the point that he was never going to perform, and moving him up to AA, which seemed very strange at the time, turned out to be exactly the right move, because then suddenly he shows up in Trenton and he's running better and he's fielding better. He even started swinging the bat better. For the first time ever, I really saw Mateo start to get into a ball and actually drives. I even saw him homer off Ryan Castellani from the Rocky system, who's a decent prospect. And it's, well, this is a new guy. This is not the player I had seen in spring training. It's not the player I was getting very soft reports on from high A. So it turned out, I mean, give the Yankees credit. They know their players. And by getting him out of there, by giving him a promotion he appeared to not deserve, it turned out to serve the player and then serve the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's use that to move on to the next guy, because, you know, for a while, he and Miguel Andujar were at the same level. And then they promoted Andujar over Mateo, and I believe that caused one of his suspensions. I could be misremembering that for sure, but I remember there was some kind of behavioral thing after Andujar got promoted and he did not.
Yeah, what I heard, I shouldn't repeat it because I may have been told this on background, but it wasn't related to that. It was a minor, very minor disciplinary thing, but sort of a, we told you not to do that and you did it. And so we're going to suspend you, which any listener with children will completely appreciate and understand.
Can't not laugh, because exactly where my mind went.
Right. I mean, that's what I have done this with my daughter so many. She's 11 now, and I'm sure within the last 4 days, I have yelled at her, otherwise punished her for something so minor, except I just told you not to do that.
I feel like I did that in the last hour.
Yeah, that's parenthood in a nutshell.
So Miguel Andujar, he's been an interesting guy in that he's been a name for Yankee fans for a couple of years now, but this is the first year where he's really cracked prospect lists. And, you know, his name has come up in trade talks. His name has come up as a possible opening day third baseman. You know, they were talking about maybe, you know, when before they traded for Frazier last year and, you know, Headley was not hitting anything. There was a lot of, where's Andujar? Why can't we call up Andujar? So the obvious thing is, you think, it's by your write-up, you seem to think that his defense is just fine.
It was fine. I saw him, and I've seen him a lot over the years, and I never thought – sometimes I see a player in any position, but you particularly see it in a third or short. You just look right away, and you're like, no shot. He's never going to have the quickness or the athleticism, or sometimes it's the arm to be able to play there. That was not the case with Andujar. It's just that his defense was, I think, a bit behind the rest of his game. I thought he improved enough this year that he would be no worse than playable, with a very good chance to be at least solid average there. And I said, I did a little media call on Wednesday morning too, where I was asked very much a very similar question, and said he could also be one of those guys too who gets to the big leagues and gets better, because there's more emphasis on defensive instruction in the majors in a lot, not all, but a lot of organizations. I mean, Orlando Hudson was a mediocre defensive second baseman when he came up to Toronto while I was in the front office. He got to working with Brian Butterfield, who Yankees fans probably remember the name. And that was his specialty, too, was working with infielders. And he turned Hudson into, I think, a legitimate gold glover. And it was the first time anyone had ever really worked with Orlando on his defense. He said, you know, that was just never an emphasis for him in the minors. So I look at Andujar as a guy who's got the physical ability to be at least a solid average third baseman, and I really think he's going to hit.
Have you gotten to see him actually do some work on third base?
I've seen him play third base. Yeah. I've not seen him like doing, you know, pregame work, et cetera. Nothing outside of, you know, normal infield outfield, which I kind of roll my. I know a lot of scouts like to watch infield outfield. I'll watch BP all day. Mm-hmm. Infield outfield, so many players just kind of half-ass that I'm like, you know, how do I know? Do you really not have a good arm, or do you just not care because it's practice?
So from what you know of the Yankees front office, do you think it's, you know, Cashman's kind of sitting there going, you know, something comes up. If Frazier's price comes down and we get him for a year, we get him. Otherwise, Andujar's the guy.
I think so. You saw his comments maybe a week or so ago. Oh. It seemed like he was really going to give him and Gleyber, you know, chances to win jobs out of spring training. I cannot imagine they would do that with Torres just because he missed time last year. He could probably just use the at-bats, and he's young. perfectly young enough to go back to AAA. Whereas with Andujar, track record says probably ready. He might come up and struggle a little bit out of the gate, but I think the next stage in his development requires coming up to face some better pitching too. So obviously I root for the prospects to get opportunities no matter where I've ranked them. And this is a guy where I would just love to see them give him a chance. They're set at so many other positions. They're going to have plenty of offense. Perfect time to plug Andujar in at third base, make him the 8-hole hitter, and tell him, just don't worry about it. We're here. This is a development year for you. We want you to get acclimated to the big leagues.
It seems like it's something that the Yankees just have not done historically, but it seems like they changed the rules in the last couple of years.
Yes. Well, they've given so many opportunities to young players, and Severino was so bad in 2016, and I was one of many people who said, he needs to go to the bullpen at this point. The new Yankees give him a second chance at the rotation. I don't know that the old Yankees do that. I think they were way too reactive. One bad year, and it was a bad year throughout, and that's it. You're done. You don't get a second chance. Now they're much more open-minded. This is a more development-focused organization, which Yankee fans should be absolutely thrilled over.
As much as the comments represent fandom, which they don't, because it's self-selecting and only a certain type of person comments, but like the general tone and comments on our articles are just completely different than they were 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think the whole organization, they talk differently about their own players. They use their players differently, even when they are still using a player, promoting a player. There, I think there's some motivation to maybe boost his trade value. You can still see the development mindset behind it. What is the plan here for this particular player? Like with Mateo, did he really deserve the promotion? Maybe not. But I think they looked at him and realized he's never going to develop if we leave him here for essentially a third year in a row. He's got to get up to another level. And then, look, if you promote him to AA and he doesn't play harder, then I think you have your answer too.
So I want to just sit with this for just a second before we move on, because I think this is something I've thought about a lot. Is that something they're going to take a step backwards with now that Dembo has left for Florida? Or is it a system thing where Kevin Reese has been part of this system? He's going to step up and be the guy that Dembo was, because it's more systematic than it is about Dembo himself.
I think it's more systematic, and it might be – I don't think it's going to be any worse without him. It might be a little better. I get the sense that sometimes Dembo was – there was some criticism of communication, that it was a little more he may have been too kind of – authoritarian is a little too strong of a word, but that he was a little too much in charge of individual decisions, maybe a little too much micromanaging. Whereas I think now it might be a little bit broader, and that Cashman may even be able to have a little bit more input on the process. I think it's going to be fine. I think they're not going to be any worse off for the exchange. There's a chance that they'll even be better off.
No one's going to complain about hearing that.
Nope.
So next guy, Justice Sheffield, new information, at least for me. And I try to follow this as closely as I can. And maybe you wrote about it and I missed it. But I did not realize that when he came back from his injury, he had completely shifted as a pitcher. I did not realize that he was any different at all.
That this is which guy?
Justice Sheffield.
Oh, Sheffield. Yes. So I saw him. It's funny. I just saw those notes today too. I had him in May throwing a slider, but it was like an in-between pitch. So in high school, he was fastball, changeup, curveball. And the curveball looked nice, but it really wasn't a very good pitch for him. But he was a lefty, and I'm sure somebody said, you're a lefty, you got to throw a curveball, which I get. It's a good way to get drafted, certainly, if you can show any kind of spin. But he was – here it is, May 11th, 92-94, might have touched a 5 in the first, and it was clearly a slider by velocity, but it wasn't very good. And then the changeup, which he's just always had a great changeup, and he's athletic, and he can repeat the delivery. Then he gets hurt. He comes back. He didn't really pitch that much in the regular season after coming back. I see him in fall league then, and suddenly he's 94 to 96. I think he touched a 7. The slider was 86, 87. Now it's a true slider for him too. And the changeup was still good. He really didn't lose anything off of that. And he didn't throw a single curveball in the entire, I think it was a 5-inning outing. They really stretched him out in fall league, which is fantastic. Because usually fall league first week, every starter throws 2 innings because they're trying to build them back up. Sheffield and Abreu both threw 5, I think, because they were essentially trying to catch up on lost innings. And, you know, then it made sense. You see it and you realize the guy's arm, his arm has gotten quicker anyway. And when your arm is that quick and you really can't spin the curveball, try a slider. Maybe just with pure arm speed, you can turn out a pretty good slider. And it turned out he threw out one that I thought flashed probably plus. I mean, you could probably go 60, 60, 55 on his 3 pitches right now, with 50 being average. So I'm saying 2 well above average pitches and 1 that's above average. That's a really good big league starter, and he's left-handed and he's really athletic and everyone loves the makeup. The Cleveland people were crushed to let him go because they loved the kid. So there's a high floor and still, I think, some pretty high upside with him.
So would you say he was like a back half of the top 100 before you saw him in the fall league and that kind of propelled him into the top 20?
He was literally back half last winter. Mm-hmm. And so probably would have been more towards the middle. But then either seeing him or, you know, obviously if I talked to someone who saw the new stuff, you know, that would have been enough to run him above the list. And I've always kind of liked him. It does help when I have a long history with a player and have seen the progression and know the athleticism. I'm a big, big fan of running athletes up the board when they show baseball aptitude, which he, you know, now he's got that. He's throwing strikes, more strikes at least. And now he's got the third pitch. It's sort of, all right, suddenly he's checking just about all of the boxes for a potential, you know, above average, if not better, major league starter.
Yeah. And, you know, we had talked about him in last week's episode, and I had mentioned that, you know, I can see him as a guy that the Yankees keep down all year. You know, he did miss times last year, might have made up some in the fall league, but he's in, maybe I'm thinking in the old style, but if they get, if the Yankees get a 6 starter, I can totally see him being the guy who they keep down all year. You know, they have Acevedo who they might bring up earlier than later. They have Adams they might bring up earlier than later. But you talking to you, it sounds like he might force his way into the rotation at some point.
Well, if you're going to bring a guy up for a spot start or two, then it's Acevedo or it's Adams. If you're going to bring a guy up and think this is somebody we want in the rotation for the rest of the year, that's where it's Sheffield. I think Sheffield is the guy whose development you manage carefully, whereas the other two guys, like I think Acevedo is probably a reliever in the end. It's kind of a rough delivery that it's amazing he throws strikes, but he's never going to have much command of it. So if he comes up, makes a spot start for you, and you take him off his routine, okay, fine, not a huge deal. Sheffield is the one you really want to micromanage it and make sure everything is exactly as planned, as much as his health permits.
All right, and then we get to the cream of the crop, the top of the list, the guy that every Yankees fan knows and loves and wants to see him pinstripe sooner than later, Gleyber Torres. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, you had the write up, and it's a really good write up, and we're trying to drive people, you know, to the insider.
Thank
for you.
Yep.
So I don't want to go and like read off it or anything, but I did want to ask you a question about his Tommy John surgery. So that was on it, it's very weird. He throws with his right arm, but it was his left elbow that he had surgery on, and that's, you know, his lead elbow. You know, when he hits, and I know that, you know, left shoulder injuries for right-handed hitters can be an issue because it's where you get your power from. How much is that elbow, do you think, going to play into his swing as he, you know, gets back into the groove in spring training?
My hope is that not at all, because part of the rehab process too involves some strengthening of the muscles around the elbow. It's not like it's not supposed to be like a shoulder where, you know, especially if they do have surgery and then you're healing from a very serious surgery on the shoulder joint, or you're constantly trying to strengthen around it to minimize the soreness. Here, the problem, the blown ligament has been repaired. They do a lot of strengthening to take pressure off the elbow in the short term while the ligament heals. So as long as he does not suffer a second tear of any sort, he really should be 100%, maybe more by the middle of the season than the beginning. You know, maybe he's not going to quite extend out front the same way. He may just have fear too. If you talk to a lot of pitchers, it's mostly pitchers who have Tommy John, they will speak about the fear of, well, I didn't want to let it go at first because, you know, you're afraid it's going to snap. You feel scar tissue tear and suddenly you get worried. Oh, God, did I just tear the ligament again? So there may be some of that. He's also not a big power hitter. He's not a big, you know, huge finish type of guy. So I'm hopeful that if that were an issue at all, it would be less of one for him because he's a contact guy and his swing is not terribly long and he's very happy to stay short and just go the other way.
Yeah, and you seem to think that that's going to lead to a lack of power from him.
It might be worried about it. If he comes into power, it's going to be because he's making a lot of hard contact. Mm-hmm. But I love him as sort of all fields. I saw him at 18 in high A. He'd been brought up to high A at the end of the year to Myrtle Beach. They played right here in Wilmington. And I remember him showing a two-strike approach, and I thought, I haven't seen a guy do that since, like, Jeter. I mean, there's so few players now who really have a two-strike approach when they're that young. Guys have two-strike approaches in the big leagues. But now it's two strikes, swing harder, which is fine, gets you to the big leagues. I'm not going to argue with that. But to see Torres do that and stay back and just shoot one right up the middle on kind of a pitcher's pitch behind in the count, this kid's probably pretty unusual in his feel for hitting at such a young age. So if he ends up only a guy who hits 10 homers a year, but he's putting the ball in play all the time and he's getting on base and he's got some doubles power, and I really do think he can stay at shortstop, that's still a hell of a player.
Staying at shortstop is one thing. Being able to play shortstop with Gregorius there is another.
Right.
I just don't see the Yankees moving him off the position now. It seems like he's kind of like the almost the archetype for the kind of player they're going for these days.
Yes.
If not drawing the walks, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and at shortstop, you obviously have a lower offensive standard. I will say the power that Gregorius showed, I wonder how much is him and how much is everybody's hitting for power now.
Yeah.
Because I saw Didi a lot as a minor leaguer and thought he could really play the heck out of shortstop, but did not think he would ever come into this kind of power. And I just – maybe he really did, but I feel like with a lot of players now, we just can't tell.
Yeah, and what was crazy about his power last year wasn't at Yankee Stadium.
Right. It was everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, you know, I just, some of these guys, if you look back at so many players, I said, well, I think he might get to 20 homers. I think he might get to 18 homers. Just throw them all out the window. Everybody's going to hit 30.
Yeah. And we have no idea how that's going to play this year. If the balls are the same, like how is everybody going to adjust?
Right. I have no idea. And it's why, with a lot of guys, I've tried to say, well, I think he might get to 25 homers and then just try to qualify it with something else. Well, it's plus raw power because I don't know what the scale is anymore. Everything I said 2 years ago looks very wrong on home run totals because the whole environment changed on me.
Yeah, exactly. You're a believer that it's something with the balls, right?
Oh, I think there's no question. I think the work that Rob Arthur and Ben Lindbergh and Mitchell mm-hmm. Lichtman have done pretty much proves it.
It does. And I don't know, what I don't get is to, you know, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but I don't get why Major League Baseball doesn't say, yeah, we changed the balls a little bit. They're still within specifications, but, you know, the game needed adjusting.
They have argued that, I've talked to people at Major League Baseball. Their argument is not that the baseball changed, but that if there were changes, which we will neither confirm nor deny that there were changes, but if they were, it's just because this is a handmade product and sometimes there's changes. So I'm willing to accept that explanation, that it was not a direct order. I don't think they've called the factory and said, hey, ixnay on the oost ball jay. Mm-hmm. So because they're clearly happy with the results.
I mean, my brother is a big football fan. Mm-hmm. He's like baseball. He's never into it. Came back for Christmas this year. And like we talked baseball from when I picked him up to the airport till we got to my parents. And most of the time he was here. It was just he's just so back into baseball because of this.
Yeah.
And I think that's, there was all this talk was like, no, it's constantly going on. But I remember a lot of stuff 2 years ago. Oh, how are we going to get more people interested in the game? Well, people like strikeouts and people like dingers.
Yep, that is absolutely true. And they, you know what? I would argue people like seeing athletes do athlete things. So I wish we saw more guys running the bases, more guys stealing. I understand why we don't, but I do think that excites people. I think great defensive plays can excite people, but you can't create that. And we have a little less of that now because hitters aren't putting the ball in play to the same extent that they used to. But because we're getting strikeouts, we're getting huge velocities, we're getting towering home runs, fans like them. I don't know how sustainable this is for the long term because the sport looks very different, but it's working right now.
Exactly. And you might as well go with it. And if you can change the ball and change the game, you can make a lot of changes to the game.
Yes.
What was it, 2012, 2013, they changed the strike zone. They were starting to call a lot lower pitches strikes. Completely changed how hitters were hitting.
It did. And now last year, they started to creep the bottom of the strike zone up just a little bit. They haven't reversed all of the lowering of the strike zone, but I would be completely fine if they wanted to creep it up another half inch or so we can get because those pitches aren't really hittable. Mm-hmm. If a pitcher wants to make a pitcher's pitch just below the strike zone to get a swing and miss, that's fine. But if a hitter can't reasonably put the ball in play, then it probably shouldn't be a strike, and it might help are sort of, you know, low balls in play problem right now.
Exactly. So there's two guys we're going to talk about for just really briefly, because they were on Baseball America's Top 100. They were not on yours. And people are going to crow. I'm sure they're already crowing about Estevan Florial not making the list. I mean, he's a very highly touted guy. You know, we have guys who are prospect followers like, oh, he's a true five tools guy. So first of all, you know, if you want to talk about why he specifically didn't make the list, but I'm really more interested in, you know, the different, like where your process might have differed from somewhere else, someone else's that would have that, you know, he was top 30 in Baseball America and he's not on yours at all. So the, you know, the process is kind of more interesting to me.
And I'm going to be a little cautious because as a policy, I just don't comment on other people's lists, just a matter of professional courtesy. I know those guys. Like I know JJ Cooper really well over at BA and think quite highly of him. So I, you know, I want to be cautious not to directly criticize.
And I'm not going for that.
And you're not asking me to. No, I know you're not. This is more for listeners who are like, who might hear me maybe sort of measure my words a little bit. But Florial's a guy I did get to see four or five games over the season on three separate occasions and talk to, again, I mentioned earlier, scouts were all over Charleston. So I talked to a lot of guys who saw him. And he was one of many players I considered for the very back of the list, but he ultimately didn't make it, in part because when I circulated draft the list, nobody was stumping for him. He is a four tool player. The fifth tool is the hit tool, and that's usually the most important one, and he does not have it right now. And I had a lot of people on Twitter say to me, well, I got a lot of why wasn't he on your list, to which the sort of honest but smart ass answer is because I thought 100 players were better. But it's a little more complicated than that. People said, well, is it the strikeouts? You know, it's not just one thing. Usually if a player isn't on the list, unless it's, say, he doesn't have enough of a fastball, it's usually not just one thing. In his case, yeah, he strikes out a lot, but not that much more than a lot of other prospects of similar caliber. His approach at the plate, his recognition of pitch types is very, very poor right now. It can get better. It absolutely can get better. And my understanding is he's a great kid. He's an unbelievable story. Like, I would love to see this guy get to the big leagues, be the first Haitian-born player ever in Major League history. That would be fantastic. But the honest truth is right now this guy cannot pick up an off-speed pitch. And because he can't, I have seen him swing through a lot of very hittable fastballs too, because he is honestly often just guessing at what pitch is coming. He does not have great instincts overall. He looks like a guy who has not played the game very much. And so his instincts on the bases aren't good. And in the field, he'll make a great play and he'll turn around and run a horrible route on a play. He needs a lot of time for a guy who is 19. He looks more, in baseball terms, kind of like he's 17. He's just a physical specimen. He can run and there's power and he's got a great arm. So the other tools are there. There's a lot of guys like that floating around the low minors. And I'm not good enough to say he's going to hit and these other five aren't. I can look at them and say they're all pretty good. And if you give me 10 of them, one of them's going to turn out to be a really, really good big leaguer. But given how far behind he is in terms of pitch recognition and swing decisions, I did not feel comfortable putting him over, you know, say the last five players on the list.
What's kind of cool about him, though, is you'll get probably get a pretty good look at him because he'll be in Trenton next year.
No question. I'm going to see a lot of him over the next couple of years. And Scranton is maybe 2 hours in a gorgeous ballpark. I'll get plenty of opportunities to see him and to see how he develops too. He's going to get up to AA at some point. He's going to face better pitchers who can locate their off speed a little bit more. Either he's going to make the adjustment or he's not. And to maybe get get five looks at him over the course of next year with Trenton would be fantastic to see how he progresses from, say, April to end of August.
And then another guy you might have gotten a look at in the last couple of years is Chance Adams. Again, he's a guy who, and I feel like opinions on him are really split. And like, it wasn't a surprise at all that he didn't make your list. Like, I was just completely unsurprised, kind of a matter of course. He's ranks really highly with some, not with others. Where do you think? So, I mean, especially when the Yankees didn't call him up last year when they needed pitching, it kind of seemed like they might be a little down on him. So where do you see the big weaknesses in his game coming?
I think he's probably a reliever. He's a fairly short right-hander, up to 94, not a lot of plane. It's control, but not really command. He does compete. He's got a decent assortment of off-speed, but there's nothing plus there. He really physically reminds me of Jason Fraser, which is not a great comp for a guy who could be a starter. Mm-hmm. He might be pretty good as a reliever. But I looked at him as low ceiling as a starter. If he's a starter, it's probably not a league average guy, and it's more likely that he ends up in some kind of relief role. Again, asked a bunch of guys who saw him. The Yankees were kind of easy in the sense that they were really heavily scouted last year because teams were running guys in. All right, you're off your regular coverage. Go in and see the Yankees affiliates because we might have something going with them. And so Adams was a guy teams would ask for but did not rank as highly as the guys we've discussed so far. And Acevedo, I actually have Acevedo over Adams in the system, even though I think Acevedo has reliever risk, but it's a ridiculous fastball. And I always look at a guy who throws that hard too and say, you know what? There might be a better slider in there because he's got such arm speed. I wouldn't rule it out. Whereas with Adams, kind of is what he is. It's Adams is impressive that he's done what he's done and gotten this far already. But I do wonder if he sort of, strictly as a starting pitcher, kind of tops out as a 4A type and has to, then he ends up like a sixth starter swing man or reliever in the big leagues.
Yeah, the fact that they didn't bring him up last year made me think that, you know, when we see he'll make fewer than 10 starts for the Yankees.
Yeah.
And he'll be a really, well, I mean, now he might get traded in that way.
Also possible.
Fewer than 10.
I will say there's one guy on the list who, if you want to look at somebody, or is there anybody Adams like on the list? Brandon Woodruff is the one starter on the whole list who does not have a huge ceiling. And it's because he is very major league ready right now. And if you wanted to say, well, Adams, if Woodruff is on there, shouldn't Adams be there? They're not that far apart. That's the one guy who, you know, I usually don't put those low ceiling major league ready starters on the 100 because they're low ceiling. Mm-hmm. I think Woodruff's got a little more. There's just a little more stuff, a little more size. If Adams had some of that, maybe he does sneak on the list. But I should also clarify, just because a guy's not on my 100 doesn't mean I don't think he's a good prospect. These guys all have value, everyone we've discussed.
Yeah, well, let's hit that then. So there's obviously only five Yankees made it, and we just discussed Florial and Adams. And Domingo Acevedo is a guy we talk about all the time. I think he'll be one of the first guys up when they need a pitcher. Again, the spot start. But who else in the system is like really intriguing to you that, you know, not on the top 100, not in the just missed list, but a guy who very well could make it next year?
Dylan Tate. His stuff came most of the way back late in the season. They restored his old delivery. I think I got him up to 97 in a late start. It might have been a playoff start, actually, for Trenton. It's funny. I saw Trenton so much, I forget which was which. But his changeup was massively improved from when he was in college or even in the – it was a playoff start, championship series, 91 to 97. Slider, 85, 86. Kind of average, used to be better. But the changeup was so much improved. So right now we've got above average velocity. We've got at least an average slider. I think we've got at least an average, maybe better changeup. Fastball's still a little flat, but that's a lot of elements working. And now he's comfortable again. And he's loose again. This is the guy who went fourth in the country. So he's looking like that player again. So I would be pretty psyched. Actually, they got him essentially for nothing. It was the rental of Carlos Beltran. I think he gets there in some role for them this year. Thyro Estrada is never going to get a chance to play every day, and for the Yankees, I don't know that he's really an everyday player anyway. I think he'd be a heck of a utility guy, and I could see them saying, well, we want to run him up. If they have a spot on the bench, they need a backup infielder, saying, well, we want Gleyber playing every day in AAA. Run Estrada up there. He can probably play all three positions, short, second, and third. He will put the ball in play. There's no juice there. He's not going to be a great hitter, but he's one of those, does a lot of little things well enough that you're happy to have him on the bench. He's really not that far away. And they don't leave guys in AAA for long. If a guy goes to AAA and shows he fits, they're happy to move those guys right up to the big leagues, which I think is right. That's how you use AAA at this point.
Yeah. So last guy I'm going to ask you about and it's kind of fits because he's another utility infielder type is Tyler Wade. Jay and I talked last week kind of back and forth on the podcast about where he would fit within the organization. Could he be the opening day second baseman? He's always been a middling prospect, but what kind of ceiling do you see him having as a major leaguer, whether it's with the Yankees or elsewhere?
I could see him being an average everyday player. I always thought he was fine at shortstop. He was not flashy. He was not going to he's not a gold glove shortstop. But I thought he was at least an average defender at short who could put the ball in play a little bit. Just wasn't going to hit for power. And he's an above average runner too, which, you know, a lot of teams might value more. Had a really nice year for Scranton. I know they moved him around. He played five or six positions because I think they were trying to create versatility and see maybe he can be our utility guy. Would love to see him get a chance with somebody. I'll put it this way. If I were the GM of another team talking to the Yankees about a trade and I had a need for a shortstop, I would absolutely ask for Tyler Wade. I think he could, at worst, he is a fill-in regular. So maybe not a solid average major league shortstop, but I think he could be. But somebody you'd run out there for a season or two while you wait for your next shortstop to develop, and you're perfectly happy with what he gives you.
That sounds like a really good trade candidate.
That's what I think. They're so loaded with these guys. Like, if they could – I know Cash has not wanted to trade his prospects. And in some cases, he shouldn't because they took on all that money for Stanton. Why give them great prospects? But Adams is something in the big leagues right now. And Tyler Wade is a big leaguer for somebody right now. And Acevedo could probably go directly to a major league bullpen. And Clint Frazier is hopelessly blocked at this point. And you could argue that of Andujar and Torres, maybe you only need to keep one of them going forward. You put together a pretty compelling package of guys who are major league ready, so that if you're a team like the Pirates, for example, who seem to really value guys who can come in right now and be cheap, you would think that would be a great fit. I mean, I was kind of surprised to see the deal with Houston versus with the Yankees. Maybe the Yankees don't love Cole that much, but I thought the Yankees can probably put together as compelling a package of major league ready prospects, or, you know, 0-2 players who make no money, as any other team in baseball right now, which puts them in a tremendous bargaining position.
Yeah, it certainly does, and it kind of makes it, you know, interesting for the prospect huggers, because you were talking you're talking about guys who are major league ready. The prospect huggers love those guys because they don't have to dream on them as much.
Yes, that's what, to me, that's the value. If you know, look, I don't like Joe Musgrove that much. I don't really think he's a major league starter, but I completely understand why Neil Huntington said, we want that guy because he goes right into our rotation. He costs no money. We have no money. We need guys who can go in and it just throw 160 innings and not cost us anything. If you're Tampa Bay and you're trying to do a Chris Archer deal, that's it. That's right there, what I just described. All right, give me two of your major league ready guys and one elite prospect from lower in the system, and we are good.
Yeah, and that's something I'd take too. So I want to thank you for your time, Keith. It's been great, running down these prospects. It's something that everybody's, I can't believe, since I started getting into this in like 2007, how much interest in prospects has grown and how much the coverage has grown. And you've been a really big part of that.
Well, thank you. I love what I do. I feel very, very fortunate. I'm very grateful to all the readers who've allowed me to do this for a living and allowed me to write a book last year, which still is one of those, like, I always wanted to do it and I never thought I'd do it. And then I did it. And it's, there are some days I wake up and, I sort of say, I wrote a book. I actually wrote a book. Like, I will always have that thing.
For a guy who reads as much as you did, I was surprised it didn't come sooner.
Maybe I spend too much time reading and not enough time writing.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So you got the book to plug. You got ESPN Insider to plug. Anything else going on?
If you have listeners who are board gamers, I keep reviewing them over for Paste Magazine. But other than that, that's pretty much my life at this point. We'll get done with this by the end of next week. Yankees Org Report should be up Thursday of next week because that's the AL East day, according to the schedule I have. And then really a week after that, I'll turn it over and start with draft stuff. It's almost time. This college is starting 3 weeks.
That's crazy, too. I remember that just because it was the very first post on River Ave Blues was Scouting the Draft College Edition.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. And the Yankees like those. They do like their good college, their big college players in the first round. So, you were probably right on target.
Awesome. All right, everybody. Keith Law, thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we're back. That was, again, one hell of an interview with Keith Law. What'd you think, Jay?
I thought that was really cool. It's amazing to hear the insight a guy like him has on the entire system, especially hearing him talking about Perez. Keith's he's always up on it, and I think it's really I feel lucky he came on and spoke with you. So thanks a lot, Keith. We really appreciated it.
Absolutely. And, I love the Perez thing, too, especially, long time friend of the blog, Andy from Sunny Daytona Beach, is beating the drum now that there's no Keith and I talked about there's no possible way that he's 190 now, but Andy's beating the drum that he's also in no way 6'8 anymore. growing young man, and it seems like he's got all this athletic potential in him. It's going to be really, I'm going to be really stoked to see how he makes progress next year.
Yeah. So it's Thursday. And it's almost about 6 o'clock at the time we're recording this. And really the only major thing in Major League Baseball that's happened is the Mets finally joined themselves with the illustrious Jose Reyes for another year. I think he's making less than $3 million. If you remember the idea Mike had recently about infielders that could have been made available, he did bring up Reyes, but he basically said, stay away, no. Please no, never no. And luckily, the Yankees were not the team that gave Jose Reyes a contract. So no, ended up happening. Very good to hear.
That's an anti-Cashman move at this point.
Yeah. I don't know who they're going to pick up for filling that spot, but I really do believe at this point that they're just going to try to fill that extra middle infielder from within. I don't know if they're going to sign somebody. If somebody falls into their lap and you see and I don't know if I want to chase out Lee, and someone brought that up, I think, on Twitter to us. What did we think about putting Chase Utley in that role? Granted, yeah, Utley could play a little bit of first base. He could probably play another role. But I just don't know if I wanted to have another really veteran bat around that I don't think is really necessary.
No, I think they have that covered. But if they do want to add an infielder, they do have some money. One of the only things to actually come out of this just glacially slow offseason is John Paul Morosi from MLB.com had an article, I think it was this morning being Thursday, mm-hmm. that ran down how much the money the Yankees have left to spend. He said roughly $15 million, and that is taking into consideration them reserving $10 million for, you know, promotions, in-season stuff, all the things that change with payroll over the course of the season. Yeah. And that's kind of cool. I loved reading it because that's exactly what we have in our shameless plug in our payroll tracker. Like, we're right along lines with this.
Yeah, so let's look at that $15 million or so. And then the 10. So you think about $25 million you got there. So that $15 million, it's probably not going to get you Yu Darvish. I'm sorry, everybody. But I don't see Yu Darvish signing this year for $15 million. He's not getting any less than at least $19 to $21 million. Somewhere between that, he's going to make this year. I believe that. I don't know if you agree with me, but I just think that's the market.
I could see it being maybe a little bit higher. You know, I think
that, I don't see it 15 though.
No, not at all. No, I mean, so Alex Cobb, I know, is holding out for a bit more than that, but I think him getting like something like 345 or maybe like 460, that seems reasonable to me. Maybe not reasonable to him, and that might be why he hasn't signed yet. But
he's a battle-tested AL East kind of guy. You know, we saw him for years with the Rays, and you know that he can pitch in this division. So if you can get an Alex Cobb for less than, say, $15 million over the course of 3 to 4 years, I'd say that's a deal that you just got to have to consider.
Yeah, if you got Alex Cobb on 460, I would probably do that, but I would probably also dish Adam Warren just to clear a little more payroll room.
Mm-hmm. I can see what you mean.
Yeah,
he's an extra piece at this point. While he's a useful piece, he's still just an extra piece. So then let's see. Has there been really anything else going on in Yankee world? I hear CeCe's like a level 6 vegan now or something, but that's really it.
that was phenomenal. There was Lindsay Barrow from MLB.com wrote up something, worked out with CeCe last weekend, and it was an interesting write-up.
Actually, you know what's cool that we can talk about that just happened just this second? And that's why it's cool to sometimes have the internet in front of you. Christian Yelich was just traded to the Brewers.
Good for them.
So I actually heard about 2 days ago a rumor going around, and I'm sure you all did, that there was something that the Brewers were looking to do with outfielders. There was something going on. They were looking, but I didn't think they were going to just go and look at Yelich. That's a big deal.
Fits what they're doing, though. It so fits what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I've got a couple of people here. So as of this hour, while we're recording, you know, it's another big move. It's finally the big move that probably needed to happen, because that was an untenable situation for the Marlins. Christian Yelich and the Jeter faction really just did not get off on good terms. The kid basically said, if this is how you're going to treat this team, don't make me part of it. And it looks like they said, okay, you're not part of it.
Yeah, that's really kind of nuts. And what's, you know, I kind of get meta here. It's nuts that we're going to speculate about this and that and this and that by the time people listen to this Friday afternoon or Saturday or you know, over the weekend. It'll all be decided. Yeah, but I'm wondering if, you know, Louis Brinson's in the deal, and, you know, if I'm Michael Hill running the, or Derek Jeter even, running the front office for the you know, for the Marlins, I'm not trading Yelich without getting him back. And it just seems like from what we've seen earlier this offseason, they're not getting him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just really don't understand what the Marlins are doing at this point, aside from just slashing payroll and putting out probably one of the 100 lost teams that you would assume would come with a really, really strapped down kind of organization.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. That seems to be doing. This can't be the last move they're making either.
I doubt it. I don't think that they're done yet. Yeah, I don't think that they're done by any stretch of the imagination. They're going to cut as much payroll as possible, and it is what it is.
Yeah. There was an interesting – so I saw it on Twitter today, and I can't verify the quote because I don't have the audio or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently Jerry DePoto, GM of the Mariners, said something along the lines of there's more teams contending for the number one draft pick this year than for the World Series. And
yeah,
that, my friend, is sad.
Yeah, I saw that. And I also read about that article where, you know, the four big major markets in the United States were part of the four playoff teams that came to MLB this past postseason. And I've been reading a lot of this, and it all kind of goes into that. Is there some sort of collusion going on within the league? And I don't know. I really don't. It's a hard thing to speculate on, but I certainly don't like the trend that's going on. And I think that the MLB Players Association is really poorly served by its leadership, because if you look at the rate of how often free agents are being signed at this point, it's a freaking travesty.
It is. I'll not waste too much more breath on that, since I spent, 15 minutes on it last podcast. But,
mm-hmm.
Man, it's something else.
Yeah, so it's just kind of sad that we're here and we're part of this kind of situation where teams are, not necessarily in the mood to get the best players that are available on the market. They just rather wait and see. And maybe that's what Brian Cashman's still doing. It feels like it, because when you look at how the market's kind of been, and there's been some reports like that the Yankees haven't been too frequent on the free agent market. It wouldn't really shock me if they're just waiting it out. I mean, I know, was it Ken Rosenthal that said it today or something recently?
Yep. It was a couple days ago. Yeah. It was indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. All righty. So the league is awful. Owners are terrible. Players need to get paid. That's all well and good, but we have questions about baseball.
We got a couple of good questions, so let's jump into them.
Hey guys, love what you're doing with the podcast. You can probably tell by my voice that I'm a Brit, a rare thing, a fanatical Yankee fan here in the UK. But just wondered, one thing puzzles me about the current infield situation. I've been reading a lot of blog posts that say Andujar, Torres aren't ready to play on opening day. And many of those posts go on to say things like they expect the players to be brought up to the majors during the season, be productive sometime mid-season. So obviously I'm aware of the situation with service time and so on, but more broadly than that, what on earth can happen in a couple of months in AAA that's going to turn guys who are not ready for the majors in April into productive bats in the middle of the season? Just a little puzzled by that, and wondered if you guys could help. Keep up the great work.
I absolutely love this question, because if you listen to the interview with Keith Law before, he doesn't seem to think there's a problem with starting the season with Torres and Andujar. Seems like he thinks that they can just step right into those roles.
And if I think about why, the organization may not want to bring them up right away, be damned the idea that it's service time, because I really don't believe that the Yankees are in a position with either of those guys to be too concerned about service time. I think that those positions are not filled by the major league roster. So concerning service time to me would be just an act of futility. If anything, I think that they just might be worried about confidence. And that's a thing that happens with minor leaguers. That promotion up to the major leagues, is, especially if you're doing it right out of spring training, is a very big move. And on top of that, you also have to consider that aside from making that big jump, you have to deal with failure. And if failure occurs while you're in the major leagues and you get sent down again to AAA, I mean, you can get killed as a player. Some guys never recover. I don't believe that's the case with these guys. But what I do think is if they spent about maybe a month in AAA just getting their feet warm and not having expectations on them right out of spring training, I think it wouldn't do them any real harm.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. The idea that you don't want to throw them right into the fire and then have, what's your backup plan at that point, right? It's not like you're going to have a veteran backup plan at that point. The Yankees backup plan right now would be, Wade and Torres. And after them, and that's the entire problem, is if you wanted to even start the season with Wade and Torres, use your utility guy at that point. So there's not much of a fallback plan there. And I think that might be one of the reasons why they would want to put them down to the minors. What I would really like to see on this is some kind of correlational study that looks at the performance of players who start the season with the team versus those who come up midseason. Because I think we might be dealing with some notions here that don't have a basis in reality. But it just seems like that's one of the big reasons for doing this. If they're playing the service time game, they only got to be down for 2 weeks.
Yeah, the service time game just doesn't really – it doesn't wash to me. I think that this is about the players themselves. If I had to really make a decision on what I think is going to happen, I think that more than anything, one of the two starts in the majors, if not both. But I think at a minimum, I think if Torres has a great spring training, he's going to start with the big league club. I just don't see how it doesn't happen.
I think unless they sign Frazier, and it seems like every day we get further down the line, they're not going to. I think it's Andahar's spot to lose, really, for third base. And, if they sign a second baseman, they could roll at that point with Wade and Torres, both on the roster, split in time. And if you look at the free agent list, is there anyone really, because I think they're ready to go with Andahar, and every indication is that they are, and since Torres is coming off that injury, maybe that's another reason why they would keep him down. Who would you take at second base? I mean, the only guy on the whole list of the whole free agent list, I think would fit is Neil Walker. That's top to bottom. That's the only guy
I would consider. And I think if he gets a 2-year deal with somebody, he's going to want that year, and he's not going to want the 1 year with the Yankees. So I can't really see them getting Neil. I just don't see them getting him for a year.
No,
and
that's the insane part about this offseason. Is that wouldn't even be a consideration in past off seasons. Neil Walker's getting at least 2 years, probably 3 to 4 years, considering where he's at in his productivity. Now we're even entertaining the idea that he might take a 1-year deal. And I wonder, the speculation about 1-year deals, how much is that going to ramp up in the next few weeks? Once we hit the Super Bowl, what are we going to do?
The Super Bowl really is that time where players start thinking, where am I going next month? You know what I mean?
Where are we going in a couple weeks?
Yeah, yeah. Like, where am I supposed to start mailing this stuff? Where do I have to get temporary place to sleep for? You know what I mean?
Going to Florida, Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. But not only that, but where in Florida or where in Arizona? I mean, it's a realistic thing to concern yourself with, especially if you're an adult who's a veteran in the league and has children and have to concern yourself with your kids being around during the summer. There's a lot of moving parts. So if you're a veteran and you're looking at the clock and you're saying, holy crap, it's getting to the point where I actually have to report soon whether I'm a pitcher or a catcher. So, it's one of those things where I think that next week the dominoes are really going to start to fall. I can't see how it's not. Just wanted to bring up something off topic, if you don't mind. One of the guys going back to the Marlins from the Brewers is Lewis Brinson.
All right. I mean, good on the Marlins because – a guy like Yelich, he's got such a team-friendly contract. He's under contract for a long time. Brinson is the guy you got to get back for a guy like him. This isn't the Ozuna trade. This isn't the Stanton trade. There's no salary reason to trade Yelich, you got to get a player back for him.
Yeah, this is a 4-for-1 deal. They're getting another Perez, I believe, is the other big prospect, plus two more guys. So the trade's done. They're getting Lewis Brinson and Ison Diaz, and two more. So they're getting a decent deal. It looks like it seems finally there's some kind of realistic trade that the Marlins are making that looks like they're players that actually have something to do with their future. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's kind of the anti what they've done so far this offseason. I want to see Derek Jeter do well in that role, and I feel like he was part of an ownership that deliberately put themselves in this position. And that's their choice, and they're not making any friends in the early going. But I think they can make something out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to take a few years, but we'll see.
All right, longer. So it's going to take, like, this is going to be Astros-level rebuild time.
Yeah.
And I'm talking all about, right, like, the Ed Wade really bad Astros part of that rebuild time.
Ed Wade. There's a name I hadn't heard in a while. Anyhow, so what's our next question?
Hey, guys. My name is Kevin from West Orange. I absolutely love what you're doing with the podcast. It's fantastic. I've been a longtime RAB reader. I don't comment much, but I had to call in with this question because it's been sticking in my craw. The baseball season's so slow that I've been watching a lot of nostalgia videos, and I stumbled upon Wade Boggs in the early 90s as a Yankee, and every single video he's hitting weak dribblers right up the middle. And I'm curious, would he be a Hall of Famer if the shift was in play? It just seems like he had a lot of weak contact, a lot of empty hits, and they all just kind of seem to dribble through the infield. So I may be crazy, but I'm hoping that somebody can help me to the bottom of that, because it seems like he would have lost quite a few hits and not reached that 3,000 mark if they were using the shift. So that's my question. A little bit different than Judge and Sanchez, but hey, can't hurt. Thanks.
So
I love that.
I want to say that Kevin makes a good point that he might not have gotten a 3,000 with the shift, but I think
– I love this question. So
I do too,
because I don't think he would have. I got to be honest. If you had guys – in the American League, in during Boggs' career, implementing the same ridiculous shifts that you use now, I don't see Boggs hitting 3,000. I think he would have hit a hell of a lot of hits because he was just a natural born hitter. But I think defensive metrics have been placed as a priority as compared to what they were, say, about 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean that's true, and he only got 3,010 in his career, but. First of all, it's if you saw him hitting Kevin, and by the way, West Orange is a great town, almost moved there. If you saw him hitting weak dribblers up the middle in the early 90s, that is not Wade Boggs. Wade Boggs in the 80s was a beast. The man was like, if he didn't win MVPs, and sometimes he seemed robbed, sometimes by his own teammates. The man was a Hall of Famer before he even went to the Yankees. Like, he was that revered, he was that good. Before he even left the Red Sox to go to the Yankees. Like, if he had retired after the 92 season and that was it, or even if he, went to the Yankees and then retired after the strike in 94, he's a Hall of Famer. He was a Hall of Famer before he won the World Series with the Yankees or anything. So I think
about this. And just to kind of add to your point before you finish it, because I just want this homeboy to know this. 85, he hit 368. 86, he hit 357. This is ridiculous. 87, he hit 363. And 88, and he was a ripe old age of 30, he hit 366. Unbelievable. I mean, it's just a natural born hitter. Maybe at that later part of his career, those weak dribblers probably would have become outs.
Possibly. And you have to also consider, too, he was one of the most feared hitters in the league, forever. He led the league in intentional walks six straight seasons.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
No Barry Bonds numbers in there, but he was still a guy you didn't want to face. And he was a guy, who even as a lefty would bounce balls off the Green Monster left and right. He was a line drive hitter. He was not a dribbler's hitter. And again, when you get... I remember, you know, Boston let him go after the 92 season. This is like when my baseball memories were really starting to come solid. Right around.
And he was an all-star in 92. So it's not like he was coming off a bad year.
It was for him. It was a bad year. For him, it was, you know, he's 34. He didn't have the year he had in 91.
He hit 320s. What did he hit that year?
He hit 259 in 92.
259, yeah.
I remember that being like a big, oh my God, Wade Boggs on the downside of his career. So he left Boston. And I'm pretty sure he signed with the Yankees solely to prove everybody wrong. That just seemed like the thing to do. But that was, I mean, yeah, I mean, Wade Boggs was such
Wade
a
Boggs
big part of my baseball upbringing. Even though he was in the Red Sox, it was hard not to like him.
Yeah, the man's a golden god. For the years that he was with the Yankees, he was a really, really important part. And what I really think that he brought to those teams, especially between, you know, 93 and 95, were that idea that, you know, we can do this. You know, he brought that kind of winning spirit, I think, or because, you know, you have to realize the man made it all the way to the seventh game of the World Series in 86. He wasn't a bad baseball player. Him coming over to the Yankees was a good move to bring a veteran person that knew how to be a consistent winner.
And I mean, him coming to the Yankees coincided with their complete turnaround from those early 90s dark days. Like 93 was that transition season where they started to get good. And then 94, you know, he and Paul O'Neill were neck and neck for just tearing the cover off the ball.
Man hit 342 at 36 years old. You know, think about that. At 36 years old, but that's just the hitter he was. And I think it had more to do with the fact and he actually had a high power year. He had 11 home runs. Yeah, he hit 11 home runs in 94. And the man hit a total career high. I think the highest year was 24. Yeah, it was 24. It was the most he ever hit in a year.
And he never hit more than 10 in any other season except 94.
So for him to hit 11 in 94, really, I think it showed that he was still one of the guys. You know, the Boston really was wrong. It wasn't just what he did in 93, how he kind of reestablished himself. It was in 94. He even in that short period of time that, you know, that 97 games, he just destroyed the ball.
He did. So this is actually a good transition too, Jay. Because next week, we've done this, I don't know if we've done it every year, but in the past few years, we have done Retro Week, where we kind of dive into past archives. Well, it's 2018 this year, which means it's the 20-year anniversary of everybody's favorite Yankee season. So we are going to take a dive into the 1998 New York Yankees next week, reliving those memories and trying to make the rest of this offseason move by a little quicker than it has gone so far.
So one of my favorite things to do, especially with like the 1998 Yankees and 99, 2000, is to take a look at the roster and sometimes look at those teams and say, that guy was on that team. So here's a guy that I'm going to say this name. I don't know if people are going to remember him, but yeah, he was on that team. Dale Swain. Dale Swain was on that team. It just, you know, he played 30 games and he probably got a World Series ring. But to even think about the fact that that guy was on that team is still kind of crazy. Here's another guy at one point was on the roster and got into a game in the 1998 series. Joe Borowski.
Oh, yeah, man. He went on to a pretty good career.
Yeah, remember he closed for the Indians for a little bit.
Yep.
If I'm right, he had like a career year in saves. Then the very next year, exploded and basically that was the end of his career.
Yeah. Was Scott Kamenicki? Did he make an appearance on that team? Because I remember he came back. He was in the early '90s teams, and I know he came back at some point in the late '90s. And I can't remember if it was '98.
Let me see, 1998 Yankees, Scott Kamenicki. Was he with the team there? Do not see him, sir.
He was on one of those. He made an appearance or two for one of the late 90s teams. One of the great memories for us who lived through the dark years.
Yes. All right. Well, you know what, guys? I think that's, and gals and everyone else, I think that's about it for us this week. We had some cool questions from you all. We had a really great interview with Keith Law. Joe, I'm really looking forward to some stuff starting to happen in earnest. But until then, you know, I'm really enjoying talking baseball with you every week.
Oh, it's one of the highlights of the week. Love talking baseball. Love doing this. It was a little sad that, you know, life got in the way for a little while, but
yeah,
we have, we got a good cadence down. We will have plenty of guests coming up. There's, you know, a lot of Yankees writers are doing a lot of things right now, so we'll be talking to a few of them as time goes on.
And I'm going to be doing what I like to call the Yankees Twitter roundtables soon. A lot of what RAB does is rooted in our conversations that we have on Twitter, and there are a lot of cool personalities on Twitter that's kind of come with that. So maybe we'll find a few of them, and we'll kind of sit down and have a conversation about remembering big moments that kind of coincided with the Yankees and people in social media talking about them. I can think back to how it led to some really, really cool things here in New York City. Joe, I can say that you and I met because of going to some of those Yankees Twitter early events in, like, what was it, like 2009, stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I remember back in the day when it was weird to meet people on the internet, and I feel like I made just dozens of friends through just one website.
Yeah, it's really cool. So we'll kind of have a look back on that. There's a few people that I'd like to talk to. What's crazy about Yankees Twitter is, like, a few people who are some of the originals, you know, have gotten married. A few of them are famous now. It's pretty wild. And it'll be a really cool kind of thing to look back on.
Absolutely. So, we'll be back next week, probably Friday again. Seems to be our time slot.
All right. So everybody, from everybody at River Avenue Blues, and I really do mean everybody, from the two of us, me and Joe, to everybody from Mike and Ben and Sonny, Katie, Dom, all of them. Who do I miss? Steven. Steven, yeah. We really appreciate that you read what we do and that you listen to this podcast. It means a lot to us. So thanks a lot. And we'll catch you next week. I'll see you later, Joe.
See you, Jay.
Bye-bye.